The days are getting shorter. Fall migration is in full swing. That's a Baltimore Oriole that we bid adieu to. Thanks to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the call of one of our favorite backyard birds. We're looking at how weather affects birds this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The researchers at UW-Madison and the Cornell Lab amassed a wealth of bird data to suss out how certain bird species respond to extreme weather. They looked at more than 100 bird species. What do you want to know about this research? What birds are you watching in your yard? What do you notice now that fall migration is underway? We're at 800-642-1234. Jeremy Cohn is a postdoctoral research associate at UW-Madison. He co-authored a study in the journal Global Change Biology on avian responses to extreme weather. Jeremy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So let's take a look at bird migration since we're here and this week is prime time. And,
sure.
You know, what does migration typically look like right now?
So we're still a little bit early in migration. A lot of the species that are migrating through right now are some of the species that have the longest journey down to the tropics. So those include species like warblers, vireos, and some flycatchers and stuff like that.
So it's a good time to be out and watching those birds because they're getting ready for a long journey.
Yeah, for sure.
And I understand that these birds, they may not make it in their migration, that many birds don't. What are those obstacles that cause them not to be able to migrate?
Yeah, so one of the big ones is window strikes. Unfortunately, a lot of birds will often fly into windows when they migrate at night because they cannot tell that they're windows. And so a lot of birds will unfortunately strike windows and suffer mortality in that way. And another big one, and this sometimes gets me into trouble, but the presence of outdoor cats. Outdoor cats actually are a big contributor to bird mortality in the U.S. I think it's over a billion birds a year.
I mean, when you think of the bird migrating, though, you think of them in flight, and it's hard to think that there are that many obstacles in their way and that they are at risk.
So that's true. But the birds do have to stop very often along the way to, you know, replenish their food and acquire resources and stuff like that. So along the way, you know, they have to make those stops, and that way they can be predated on. And during flight, they can also, you know, hit those windows.
There are pit stops just like for us humans.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What factors go into a bird deciding whether it's the right time to migrate?
There's a couple of factors. So in the fall, when the temperatures become a little bit cooler, that's definitely a cue that it's time to start going. In addition to that, the daylight becomes shorter, so that's another cue. So those are two of the major ones that birds use to start migrating in the fall.
Do all birds migrate?
Not all birds migrate. So if you live in Wisconsin, you'll notice a few birds that are present year-round, such as cardinals, blue jays, downy woodpeckers, stuff like that. So those birds do not migrate.
Why is that?
So those birds are able to either acquire resources here year-round so they can find food even during the winter. And they must also have the ability to withstand the winter conditions so they can sometimes adjust their physiology to just deal with those winter conditions.
During the polar vortex, I just kept thinking about the birds and wondering, how are they surviving? How are they doing this?
It's pretty remarkable that they can withstand, you know, negative 20, negative 30, negative 40 degrees for 2 days straight.
And they can. Did we have much bird loss during the polar vortex?
It's difficult to say this year. We don't really have that data yet, but yeah, it's difficult to say.
We're talking with Jeremy Cohn, who's a postdoctoral research associate at UW-Madison, where he studies how climate and climate change influence bird species. Are you a bird watcher? Which birds have you been seeing lately? Have you noticed any migration happening in your area? Where do you like bird watching this time of year, and what species do you typically see? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in with your sightings, your experiences, and your questions. Jeremy, what techniques do different birds use to navigate from one location to the next when migrating?
So birds can use a variety of techniques. They can actually rely on the placement of the sun in the sky to figure out where to go. Some of them can even use starlight as well. And a couple of birds will actually memorize stopover locations. So they'll stop at specific locations on the way up and down each year. And then there's also been some work showing that birds can actually track the magnetic field of the Earth, which is pretty interesting when they're migrating.
And when they're migrating or moving as a flock, how is it decided, you know, what bird takes the lead? Or, you know, as we watch flocks of birds and their movements across the sky, I'm always wondering how they're doing this.
Yeah, I actually don't know too much about how that works mechanically, but it's really interesting to watch, you know, like a flock of starlings when they suddenly all change direction at once and go a certain way.
Yeah.
In terms of like which Canada goose takes the lead in the V, I'm not sure.
And then there are all those, you know, those little stragglers here and there way in the back. I'm like, oh, come on, catch up. But, you know, they know what they're doing. They've got they've got so many different types of compasses that we, you know, humans can't even seem to calibrate, you know, which direction we're standing. You know, what type of physical adaptations do birds make to safely migrate long distance? How do their body features change?
Yeah, so a lot of birds will put on weight before migration and then eat heavily throughout the migration in order to just maintain the energy level. And some of their flight muscles actually develop differently during the period leading up to migration. So that's pretty interesting.
Their flight muscles, you said?
Mm-hmm.
What are their flight muscles?
So this is not actually my area of expertise.
Okay.
So I'm not too sure to answer that one. But
so,
I just know generally that their bodies change when they're leading up to migration.
Jeremy, how long might they travel to get to the tropics, or how long does this journey take birds?
Some birds can be traveling for 2 months straight continuously, because there are birds that have to get all the way from the boreal forest in Canada, such as Tennessee warblers and black pole warblers. They have to go all the way from there all the way down to sometimes even past Central America down to South America. So some of these birds can travel pretty far. And then when it comes to shorebirds, some shorebirds have to go all the way from the North Pole down to the South Pole each year. And that's true for swallows as well, such as barn swallows.
Wow.
So a lot of these birds will, some shorebirds can actually keep flying for a week straight without stopping.
Oh my goodness. I mean, think about even the climate change that their body is going through as they make this progression.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with UW's Jeremy Cohn, who's our guide to a study he co-authored looking at how birds respond to extreme weather. Where do you like bird watching this time of year? What species do you typically see? What's your favorite bird to see in Wisconsin? And what is it about its appearance or behavior that you enjoy watching? Join in All Things Birds, 800-642-1234. You can email your questions on birds and migration to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in a minute with Jeremy Cohn right here on the Ideas Network. I look up into our tree canopy and see those blue jays flying about. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a credit to the Cornell Lab here. They tell us that Blue Jays are known for their intelligence and complex social systems with tight family bonds. And their fondness for acorns, that is credited with helping spread oak trees after the last glacial period. I know, right? What fascinates you about birds? What do you notice about birds in your backyard when there's extreme weather? It's 800-642-1234. Jeremy Cohn is a postdoctoral research associate at UW-Madison, and he's our guide. Let's take a call now. Carolyn is joining us from Madison. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Amongst the hazards birds face is light pollution, to the point where the city of Chicago right now has a lights out program overnight. Instead of lighting up their buildings, you mm-hmm. know, all the big buildings, making that beautiful skyline, they turn off the lights. And so does the city of Toronto, and I believe Houston just got on board recently. Because so big, you end up with so many dead birds at night. They just pour into lit-up cities.
Carolyn, thank you so much for those insights. Jeremy, is light pollution and turning off lights at night in these big cities, is that having an impact?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't seen the numbers on how effective those types of protocols are, but generally birds kind of get confused by all those lights being on in the cities during migration, and it disrupts their ability to navigate, as I said before, which they do based on starlight.
Carolyn, thanks. Yeah. Carolyn, thanks for the call. Jeremy, you co-authored this study looking at how birds respond to extreme weather in the month of June, and it was over a 15-year period of data. So introduce us to this study. Which regions did you evaluate?
So we looked at birds in the eastern United States and Canada.
And then what types of bird behaviors did you look at?
We didn't directly look at behaviors. What we did was we looked at whether birds are present or not in our data set. So I could talk a little bit about the data set just to kind of introduce that.
Yeah, give us a feel for what this data set was about.
Yeah, so we used the eBird data set, which is very popular among birders. This is maintained by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. So it's a citizen science initiative. What that means is that regular people are contributing this data through their own observations. So it's kind of unique in that sense. It's not collected mainly by scientists, but it's actually driven by millions and millions of observations. And there's actually been something like over 600 million observations that have been entered into eBird. And so those are coming from all over the world. So the Cornell Lab maintains this data set, and we can use it to answer tons of different questions about bird migration or the effects of weather on birds or really anything you want to know about birds, because we essentially know when birds are and are not present all over the world.
So this is just a vast repository of bird sightings. And I understand there's this checklist that the citizen science person does in order to contribute to eBird. Can you tell us about the checklist?
Mm-hmm. So what you'll do when you use eBird is you'll enter a checklist of the birds you sighted in a given location at a given time. So you can, this can be either, you know, looking at your feeders out the window. You can go out into your backyard and look at birds for a little bit. You can go to a park and walk around for hours. So any of that counts. So you can enter a checklist. There's a lot of different flexibility in that. And one thing we encourage, and the people at eBird encourage, is to enter what they call a complete checklist. And then you're designating that you've entered all the birds that you observed, that you're able to observe. And so using that, we can actually infer which species were not observed. And that's really important when thinking about the effects of weather on birds, because we want to know what's still there and what's not there when you have extreme weather.
Yeah, so there's just kind of this really intricate attendance that you're looking at, almost like taking attendance. Jeremy Cohn is with us. He's a researcher at UW-Madison studying how climate affects bird species. We're discussing how extreme weather events affect birds. you can join in. Have you ever submitted a bird watching report to eBird? What bird behavior did you see? What was in your checklist? Where did you observe the birds? And when did you submit your checklist? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jeremy, what did you consider to be examples of extreme weather?
So we measured extreme weather by essentially using percentiles. So something that was statistically unusual. So for example, a week that was so hot that this type of week only occurs 1% of the time, something like that. Or a month that was so dry that it only occurred 1% of all months. And we looked at data during the summer. So during June, actually.
Yeah. And why did you focus on June?
We wanted to look at the effects of extreme heat, first and foremost, and drought, which is more common in the summer. The reason we looked at June specifically is because that's the month where the fewest birds are actually moving around and migrating. And birds by June have pretty much settled into their breeding territories. So we didn't want to worry about the confounding effects of bird movement on our results. So we kind of just decided on June.
And where did you get your weather data?
Our weather data came from NASA, their DayMet data set, which is a really valuable resource. They essentially have weather data at a very fine scale, 1 kilometer scale, across the entirety of North America. And that's dating from 1980.
And so essentially you were layering one type of data on top of another.
Exactly.
Yeah, and kind of seeing where the plots mm-hmm. fell. You know, why did you strike out on this research in the first place?
Why did we go ahead and try to do this research?
Uh-huh.
So there's been some work in the past that looks at how extreme weather affects birds, but most of that work's been done either, one, banning a few specific birds and tracking a couple species in one area. And obviously, if you do that, you don't have the power to look at 100 species at a time over a scale of continent. And some other work that's been done has looked at how birds respond to extreme weather, but using data from a specific point, like one single point in time per year. So there's been some older data sets where people have gone out extensively across the United States and recorded the presence of breeding birds. It's called the North American Breeding Bird Survey. But that data is only recorded once a year. And so we can't look at, using that data, how birds react immediately following these weather events, which is what we aim to do in our paper. So the great thing about eBird is that it's collected continuously. So we have data every single day of the year, so we can see what happens right after those events.
Do you find your data was pretty clean, pretty reliable?
So citizen science data, I'm just going to be honest, is always kind of messy. But luckily, the folks at Cornell have developed a number of ways to account for some issues that arise from the data.
And this is all in the electronic format, I would imagine.
Yeah. We have, as I said before, hundreds of millions of records that have been submitted. So this all has to be done, electronically.
Do you have any idea how much influence Wisconsin has on eBird and the data you worked with?
Quite a bit of influence. There's a lot of data submitted from Wisconsin. Birding's pretty popular in the Midwest in general. And eBird, the area in the world where eBird is used the most is the eastern United States, which is another reason we decided to look at eastern U.S. data.
Are there any particular counties in Wisconsin that are particular hotspots for eBird?
I would say Dane County, for sure. There's a lot of people that are very much into birding there, and there's a lot of parks in the area. And then a bunch of the counties around Milwaukee are definitely popular as well.
Okay, so now that you're merging the eBird data with the NASA weather data and it's coming together, what are you seeing? How are you plotting this out?
So when we combine those data sets, before I introduce any of the results, I'll just mention that we didn't look at just extreme weather over one specific period of time. But we actually looked at extreme weather over the previous week, over the previous month, over the previous few months. How did each of those different timescales of extreme weather affect birds? So the idea is to find out maybe, okay, a dry week doesn't really do much, but a dry month does affect birds. So what we found was pretty interesting. We looked at birds across different types of what we call functional groups. And these are just groups of birds that are grouped by traits. So diet, length of their migration, anything like that, foraging strategy, nesting location. We looked at a variety of these different traits, and we essentially found that birds that were the most sensitive to extreme heat over the period of a week, those were the birds that either migrate very short distances or are residents in Wisconsin.
Jeremy Cohn is a postdoctoral research associate at UW-Madison, and we're understanding birds, better understanding what the data looked like at how birds respond to extreme weather. How do you see climate change affecting bird populations? What can be done to limit the effects on birds? How do you think we can better support and protect birds here in Wisconsin? And what do you want to know about bird migration? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We'll be back to talk more about birds and climate with Jeremy Cohn right after this news update on the Ideas Network. Hello to the wood thrush there, and that call courtesy of the Cornell Lab. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the DNR, Wisconsin is home to over 300 species of birds. And in the DNR's statewide birding report this week, the forecast is for warblers, vireos, thrushes, and flycatchers all to reach peak migration movement. We're learning about the effects of extreme weather on how birds migrate, nest, eat, and survive or thrive. What do you want to know about how extreme weather affects birds? What is at your feeder? What do you look forward to with fall migration upon us? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jeremy Cohn is a UW researcher who recently published a study looking at how birds respond to extreme weather conditions, and he's our guide. Let's take another call. Curtis is with us from New Berlin. Hi, Curtis.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to comment on eBird. I'm a local teacher here in southeastern Wisconsin, and I use eBird a lot with my students. I teach third grade, so it's amazing to see how students can use eBird and the data that's within it as young as 8 to get them excited about birding. And I'm really intrigued about then using climate data to see how that affects birds, because I think my students could also look at those two data sets and make some interesting conclusions.
Curtis, tell us a little bit more about how you use eBird in the classroom.
Yep, so I usually start off by just teaching children how to identify birds. And then we have some local parks in our city, so we go out and students at that point are using checklists on paper. And then when we get back to the classroom, each student can then upload that data into eBird using my classroom account. And then we're able to keep track over many years of the birds that we see.
Oh, this is great. Jeremy, what can you tell Curtis about how he could take it to the next level and incorporate climate?
That's really fantastic to hear about that program in that school, for sure. What I would say is simply, download some weather data corresponding to all of the checklists that have been recorded, or at least just for a single year, and just kind of look at which species are associated with which different temperatures. And it would be pretty straightforward for even, elementary school students to just take a look at, for a select group of species, whether they were observed on a given day and what the weather was like that day, and just kind of draw some conclusions from that.
So looking at the species of birds that you looked at, 109 in all, what did you learn when you pulled that data together with these birds, 109 bird species?
Yeah, so as I was saying before the break, we found that with very extreme heat, the birds that were migrating very short distances or that were residents, those were the birds that were typically more sensitive to that kind of weather. The birds that migrated long distances were not quite as sensitive.
I wonder why that is.
So the long-distance migrants, we think, first of all, they winter in the tropics, which, you know, the tropics are pretty hot year-round. So they're used to those tropical hot conditions. That's what we think. And then a second reason may be that those birds are primarily insect eaters. And so those birds might be out on the hot days because they're tracking those insects, which are also out on warm days.
Ah, so the conditions, they're able to withstand more extreme conditions, and also mm-hmm. because they can find food on those days when there yeah. is extreme weather or extreme heat. So let's take a look at our state bird, the robin. How does it respond to extreme weather?
When it comes to robins, we found that they're pretty resilient. Pretty much when you go out during the spring, you're going to see robins no matter where you go or what type of day it is. So this is just such a widespread bird that they're not really considered to be too sensitive to extreme heat, even though they are a very short-distance migrant.
Were there any outlier species of birds in your research, birds that just didn't follow the norm of your trend lines?
I would say robins are a good example of that because, as I said before, some of the residents and short-distance migrants, those species were the most sensitive. Whereas robins, even though they do fall into that category, they were not very much sensitive to extreme heat. An example of a species that was pretty sensitive was chickadees. So chickadees, when it was hot out, were less likely to be out and about.
But they're so cute. Oh my gosh, they're adorable. So these short distance migratory birds, give us some examples of short distance migrants.
A lot of sparrows are short distance migrants. Eastern towhees are another example. Robins, red-winged blackbirds, another one. Grackles. So there's quite a few short distance migrants in Wisconsin.
Is there any way to know whether adaptation over time, over millennia, and how the birds change to adapt to the changing climate? Is there any way to track that?
So the climate definitely has changed naturally in the, you know, geologic past of the Earth. The issue is that those changes typically occurred over the span of millennia, or, you know, tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of years. So in the past, the birds had time to adapt, evolve, and kind of acclimate to those new conditions. The climate change that's occurring now is occurring over the span of a century or two. And so there's many, many fewer generations for the birds to be able to adapt and, you know, change to handle these types of conditions.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about climate and birds and how they are able to adapt to extreme weather. Jeremy Cohn is with us, and he recently, his study looked at 109 bird species over a 15-year span in the North American region to learn how the birds react to extreme weather. Taking your questions, your calls, how do you think we can better support birds in Wisconsin? What questions do you have as to how birds respond to extreme weather? What have you observed about birds and in extreme rain or drought in your own backyard? We're at 800-642-1234. Jeremy, when there is extreme weather, how can we be better stewards to the birds in our own backyard? I mean, if there is a drought, should we be making water available in our backyard?
Yeah, definitely. When there's a drought, keep water available. Just in general, keep the feeders stocked. When the weather is really poor, birds rely on the safest type of food source that they can possibly find. So it's really good to have those feeders available for the birds, so that they can rely on them, especially when the weather is very cold or very hot.
Matt from Wausau emailed to ask if you knew about the massive migratory bird die-off in the desert southwest. And Matt says it's affecting thousands of species.
Yeah, absolutely. So for anyone who hasn't seen this story, it was reported in the last few days or a week that, especially in New Mexico, lots of migratory birds were found dead and deceased all over the place. This only seemed to affect migratory birds, not the birds that are there year-round. So Why might that be the case? No one really knows for sure yet. One theory that's been floated is that some of these birds migrate along the closer to the west coast, and so they were pushed inland by the smoke and the fires and all that. Another potential explanation is that just a couple of days right before this happened, in Colorado, the temperatures went from being around 101 degrees to 95 degrees for a couple of days, which was the latest that's ever been that hot in Colorado.
And didn't they get like a snowstorm then like the next day?
Exactly. So literally the next day after it was 95 degrees, the temperatures plummeted to 30 degrees and they had snowstorms. So a lot of these, you know, birds that go down to the tropics for the winter, they're not used to seeing that kind of weather. So given that, you know, Colorado is just north of New Mexico, it's likely that a lot of these birds probably came from that weather system. And so they were unable to find food for a few days when it was, you know, winter weather outside. They're not adapted for that.
And when it's vital for them to be able to get that nourishment to stay on in flight.
Exactly.
So if a bird has to go way off course in its migration, what effect does that have on the bird?
Well, it's going to be using a lot more energy than it normally would because it has to fly much further. And so, especially if it has to make that detour without the ability to stop because either there's fires or there's a snowstorm, it's going to be really difficult on the bird. And a lot of the birds that were found in this case were found at pretty low weights, so weights that are below what they would normally be at during migration. So that indicates that they might have been without food for a few days.
Is there anything that could have been done to prevent this?
Other than long-term accounting for climate change, it's difficult to say what kind of short-term changes could have been done.
We have another call here, called in to ask if you have any suggestions for bird education or bird books for younger children and how they can better understand bird migration.
I guess I don't spend a lot of time thinking about books for, you know, elementary age kids or anything like that. So I don't have anything like lined up.
Sure.
I would guess using just like a Sibley guide or another bird guide. And there's also many online resources as well. There's Birds of North America by the Cornell Lab. That's a great resource for education. And there's pages on every single bird in North America. So there's a couple of good resources online.
Jeremy Cohn is a postdoctoral research associate at UW-Madison. And we're learning how birds respond to extreme weather and the results of his study. How do you see climate change affecting bird populations? What can be done to limit the effects of our warming climate on bird species? How do you think we can better support birds here in Wisconsin and their migration? Still time to talk with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Jeremy Cohn right here on the Ideas Network. That is a black-capped chickadee, courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. We're talking birds here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Cornell Lab describes this chickadee as almost universally considered cute, thanks to its oversized, round head, tiny body, and curiosity about everything, including we humans. Do you love chickadees or another bird? How do you make your yard a sanctuary for birds? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. UW-Madison researcher Jeremy Cohn looks at how climate influences species distributions and ecological patterns, and he's co-authored the study published in the journal Global Change Biology. Let's take another call now. Gary is joining us from Boscobel this morning. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, and I understand you're a wildlife photographer.
Well, I try, but mostly a hobby. but I've been doing it for, oh, I don't know, 20, 30 years, something like that. And I live over here in Boscobel, and I have a lot of haunts that I check out, prairie remnants that I watch, and sloughs in the river bottom, and also along the Kickapoo and also on the Mississippi River. And I spend a fair amount of time in Nebraska in the sand hills photographing birds out there.
Oh, beautiful.
And usually, I don't know the numbers, but usually I'll take maybe upwards of 500 to 1,000 images in a year's time, mostly of wildlife, focusing on birds. And this year, all of the places where I photographed trumpeter swans or warbler migrations or waterfowl hatches or lots of places where the old oxbows on the Kickapoo River would have a myriad of bird life and bird activity there, and it dropped to almost zero this year. I don't think I've taken 50 pictures all summer, and it's I also sometimes you see a couple of years ago we had a real vigorous red-headed woodpecker population. You see them frequently, and then that population drops down, and I don't know if they actually disappear or whether they just shift the areas that they're inhabiting and move around, but there seems to be undulations in populations and variations. But this year it was all species that ever use these wetland areas or these prairie areas. And then last winter my bird feeder population, and this year too, the number of orioles that were here and the number of rose-breasted grosbeaks are also diminished quite a bit. So I don't know if it's climate change or not, but it's extremely alarming to see that change in just 1 year's time.
Gary, thank you for bringing those observations. Jeremy, what might be going on as Gary sees behind the lens of his camera that a great drop-off in the species?
Yeah, so there was a study that came out of the Cornell lab this past year that showed that North America has lost about 3 billion birds since the 1970s, so over the last 50 years. So that's about a quarter of the birds that were here at that time. And climate change is definitely, we think, responsible for some of that. There's also factors including land use change. That's a big one. So conversion of natural habitat to developed areas, especially an important habitat for birds, either for their breeding or for their migration. Those are very important.
And that might also be the reason why Gary would see an extreme drop-off. Like, what would an extreme drop-off from 1 year to the next mean?
There could be some relationship with extreme weather. A specific event occurred in the past year. A big event that occurred last year was the polar vortex, but that was before last breeding season. So it's hard to think of an event in Wisconsin since then that was quite as major. So hopefully the populations in his area bounce back. I can say that I did not notice quite the same type of drop off in my area, so that's at least a little bit better. But
let's take another call now. Let's go to Nels in Benton. Hi, Nels.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if there had been any studies in Wisconsin about how the large windmill farms are affecting migratory birds. I know they have a big problem with that on the West Coast, where there are thousands of birds killed as they fly through the areas where these big windmill farms are.
Nels, thank you. What is the effect, Jeremy, of these windmill farms?
Yeah, so windmill farms have a pretty bad reputation when it comes to birds. But it seems like a lot of that is actually pretty unfounded. So the amount of birds killed by windmills is actually less than 1% of the amount that are killed by window strikes. And it's less than 1 in 1,000 of the amount that are killed by outdoor cats. So when it comes to the factors affecting birds, windmills actually make up less than 0.01% of bird mortality in the U.S. So, I mean, any mortality is not great, but there's other factors that are definitely the big contributors to bird mortality.
We're talking with Jeremy Cohn, who is a postdoctoral research associate at UW-Madison. We're looking at his research into how dozens of bird species are affected by extreme weather, and we're looking at birds overall and the impact of climate change with your questions at 800-642-1234. So, Jeremy, now that you have this data on how birds respond to extreme weather, where do you go from here?
So we actually followed this study up with another study that looks at the effect of extreme events that occur in winter. And as opposed to the first study where we just kind of looked at, you know, weeks that were or months that were statistically unlikely in terms of extreme heat. So that was like statistical outliers and extreme in that way. We looked at specific events in this new study. So we actually looked at the effects of the polar vortex in 2014 directly, what birds were doing before, during, and after the polar vortex. And then we also looked at a heat wave that occurred in 2015, where temperatures around Christmas were, I think, in the 70s for like a solid week. So we looked at what the effect of that was on wintering birds.
Ooh, what did you find?
So we found that the polar vortex definitely affected some birds. We saw that birds dropped off in their occurrence for about 2 to 3 weeks after the polar vortex, and then started to climb back up and recover slowly. So they were, you know, hunkered down. There might have been some mortality of birds that were then replaced by birds coming from other areas or something like that. But when it came to the heat wave, birds actually increased their activity levels. So they were taking advantage of the warmer periods in the winter to forage a bit more.
Oh, so the extreme heat, the heat wave at the time of year when we don't normally get a heat wave, that actually worked in the bird's favor and they made use of it.
Right. So you can't generalize like a heat wave in the summer versus a heat wave in the winter. A heat wave in the winter is actually, you know, more favorable conditions for some of these species.
So as climate change continues, how do we protect birds? How do we keep them from having massive die-offs?
I would say the number one thing is to protect as much land as possible. So as much land as we can require for preserves and conservation to ensure that birds have habitat both during their breeding season, during migration, and during their wintering periods, which are often in the tropics for a lot of these birds. So ensuring that the habitat is there. And then what, you know, ordinary people can do is keep those feeders stocked. And if you have cats, try to keep them indoors as much as possible, I would say. And I have two cats myself. I love cats for sure. But they are definitely...
Thank you for the disclaimer, Jeremy.
They're definitely contributing to some issues.
And before we go, if you do create more habitat, it means that birds can also not only find a home, they can find food.
Yeah, exactly. So finding food, you know, along those migration routes, that's really important.
Well, Jeremy, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jeremy Cohn is a postdoctoral research associate at UW-Madison. He and two other researchers recently published a study. It's in the journal Global Change Biology, looking at avian responses to extreme weather. We have a link to the study results at WPR.org/mornings. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.